I'm Tom Hall. This is an archive edition of Midday. We're talking trees today, the urban forest, the street trees and parkland trees that make Baltimore and many other American cities cooler in the summer and gorgeous in the fall. But the urban forest is so much more than ornamental. Although we often take them for granted, trees in cities clean the air, lower the incidence of asthma, reduce our utility bills, and absorb vast amounts of storm water that would otherwise gush into the harbor and the bay. Jill Jones is the author of Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. Eric Deal is the Baltimore City Arborist and Chief of Urban Forestry. They join me to talk about what trees can do for us and what we can do for them. We can't take your calls during this special archive edition of Midday, which starts right after the news. And welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you are with us on this Tuesday afternoon. So when you look up, what do you see? Think about it. If you're in Baltimore and many other cities, you see a bunch of buildings, but you also see trees. And when viewed from above, the tree canopy, as it's known, covers more than 27% of Charm City. And if today's urban arborists have their way, that figure will be significantly higher 20 years from now. So today, a conversation about urban forests. What purpose do they serve in our daily lives? Who planted them and why? What lessons did we learn from the mid-20th century disaster known as Dutch elm disease or the emerald ash borer, which have decimated the urban tree cover in cities across the United States? And what do today's science and technology reveal about the importance of the grown environment in American cities? My guests today in Studio A are Jill Jones and Eric Deal. Jill Jones is an author and historian and self-described tree hugger. She's also the author of 6 books. Her latest is called Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. She's the founder of the Baltimore Tree Trust and a scholar in residence at the Woodrow Wilson International Center in Washington. Jill Jones has also been both a Ford Foundation and a National Endowment for the Humanities scholar. She's based here in Baltimore. It's good to see you again. I know you're fighting back a cold, but thanks for coming in.
Well, always fun to be here.
And Eric Deal is Baltimore City's arborist and chief of urban forestry. He leads Tree Baltimore. That's the city's tree planting initiative, which works with nonprofit partners, including the Baltimore Tree Trust, to increase the city's tree canopy. Before taking over the care and feeding of Baltimore City's urban forest 6 years ago, he was the director of horticulture at Arlington National Cemetery. It's nice to have you as well, Eric. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you, Tom.
So, Jill, this is a really interesting, fascinating book, which is the same thing I said about the last couple of books that you were over here talking about. And I'm interested in the subjects that you choose for your tomes. You wrote a great book about the Eiffel Tower and the World's Fair and what was it,
1889.
Another wonderful book about building the tunnel from Jersey to Manhattan.
Conquering Gotham.
Conquering Gotham and, Madison Square Garden and all that kind of stuff. So how did you alight upon trees and the urban forest? It's really it's a departure from certainly those other kinds of subjects.
Well, it actually is not as big a departure as you would think, because I realized as I was pondering this question myself that all of my books are about cities and infrastructure. And I realized, so all that's different here is we're talking about green infrastructure. So most of us are very aware of the built environment in cities. We have opinions about the way the buildings look or, how the streets navigate and what have you. And there is also this grown environment that's dominated by trees, and most of us experience it intuitively. And I would say up until about 8 years ago, I totally fell into that category. I mean, I like trees, and I probably knew more than most people because I could tell an oak, say, from a maple. But as I finished my Eiffel Tower book, I was thinking about what I wanted to do next, and I really feel that climate change is the issue of our day. And I wondered, what could I write that could be meaningful? And I always have wondered why, in response to climate change, we have not had a worldwide tree planting push, aside from just saving the existing forests. And since most of us now live in cities all over the globe, how do you cool down cities? What do you do about cities? There's actually very few things to do, but one is to have what some scientists now refer to as a maximum strategic urban forest. So I got going on this, and I honestly say, I have to say, I knew nothing. So I started where most people start, unlike Eric, who is an arborist and knows a lot about trees and ran nurseries and, you know, has had a big career, and we're incredibly fortunate to have him here as our chief forester. So everything in this book is what I learned in the process of, you know, trying to look around me and understand all these trees and what they can do for us and how we should think about them.
So, Eric, I'm also one of those folks that doesn't know a whole bunch about trees. I can't tell the difference between a red oak and a maple. Okay. I can tell the difference between, like, a Christmas tree and a palm tree.
So
it's a start.
You're going in the right direction.
But this notion of climate change, and Jill brings this up repeatedly in the book, explain to us the science of this. How do trees cool down the city? How do trees counteract the ill effects of climate change?
Well, no pun intended, but it is truly the low-hanging fruit to combat climate change. In most all cities and around the world, they see one of the first thing you look to is trees to bring down this cooling effect. So the trees literally will lower air temperatures in what we call heat islands. And Baltimore has some very severe heat islands here in the city world because of reflections from pavement, lack of canopy cover. The temperatures are much higher. The trees have been shown in numerous studies that if you plant them and fill in the blocks and you have parks nearby and you have clusters of trees, it literally lowers the ground air temperature. And in turn, that can, of course, mean immediate benefits for residents here in Baltimore, and that it lowers your utility bills.
So let me ask, lowers the temperature of what? When you say the ground air temperature, does that mean, you're not talking about the asphalt on the street. I mean, without trees, that might be 100 degrees on a bad summer's day, but with trees, it might be 85 degrees? Or is it the 2 feet above the street? What temperature are we lowering?
I think it's usually 4 to 10 feet up where you and I would be if we were walking down the street having a conversation. We'd feel we're even working with Johns Hopkins and with our Office of Sustainability, where MICA students and Johns Hopkins students have placed monitors in different heat island areas throughout the city. And we're getting both moisture data, humidity data, and air temperature data to confirm our heat islands and how much it lowers the temperature. And those monitors are not very noticeable, and we've had good success in not having them taken down. They're about, 4 to 10 feet off the ground.
Can you give me an example of a heat island? Like an address, a place that people would recognize?
I think you'd find these in South Baltimore. You'd find it in what we used to call maybe some of our underserved or underrepresented neighborhoods where you have low canopy cover. For example, Jill's group, Baltimore Tree Trust, has done a lot in Highland Town. Now they've planted hundreds. How many, Jill?
In Highland Town. We are actually in
McKeldry Park.
Right, McKeldry Park, Elwood Park. So the Harris Creek watershed, which no one's ever heard of because Harris Creek has been in a pipe since 1880. But, I mean, when we started planting there in 2012, I mean, there would just be blocks. I mean, like Linwood. We planted on North Linwood starting around Patterson Park. And the difference, I mean, before that, if you walked out of your house, I'm guessing the temperature easily could have been 10 degrees higher, if not more.
Mm-hmm. By the way, what's the deal with Harris Creek? Because you're right, I'm one of those folks who's never heard of that either. What do you mean it's been in a pipe since 1880?
So, reportedly,
sounds like Uncle Fester chained to the radiator in the basement. What's that all about?
So, reportedly, Harris Creek emerges somewhere in Clifton Park and immediately goes into this pipe that it's been in since 1880, and it comes down through 17 communities and is finally visible as it exits the pipe just below the Safeway in Canton. And just as there is a trash wheel for
Jones
Fall
and
the harbor, there's right now going to be a trash wheel for Harris Creek.
Harris Creek, the creek that's in a pipe.
The creek that is in a pipe. But what that means is that all the rain that comes down in those communities and goes into the storm drains goes into this pipe. And so, you know, every time we open a tree pit or plant a tree, we are literally diminishing the amount of stormwater that goes out. That's, you know, one of the many wonderful things. I think of trees now as sort of civil servants. Citizen trees.
You say citizen trees. You say in the introduction to the book that they act as giant wicks.
Yeah.
Natural air conditioners. So they're wicks in what they soak up the heat and disperse it so the rest of us don't have to deal with it.
The other sort of air conditioning part of it is that trees literally are putting off sort of I guess it's almost an invisible mist of water.
Because of transpiration, they're actually having water come off their leaves, and that can have a cooling effect also.
Right.
Right. But back on the heat island, so this McElderry Park where Jill's folks have done a lot of work is an example. We'll see in the coming years how it continues to lower the ambient ground air temperatures in the years to come. And we're doing this at a number of locations throughout the city.
Is there a corollary between the relative affluence or lack thereof of a particular neighborhood and the density of the tree canopy here in Baltimore?
I think there is. Now, I think there can be correlation, Tom. So, for example, we'll look at Guilford, we'll look at Roland Park, we'll look at Homewood, and we'll look at Mount Washington. And you do see a higher level of tree canopy in those areas. And there, I believe, is more affluence in those areas. Some of the more poorer neighborhoods, there is definitely less trees. It's not an absolute correlation, but that's one of the places we're focusing on here in the city, or again, what I would call these underserved neighborhoods.
So when we talk about expanding the tree canopy, planting a whole bunch more trees, we're talking about neighborhoods like Sandtown or Harlem Park.
Exactly.
Or the places that really need them.
Yes. Yeah,
exactly. This is true in cities everywhere. And actually, one of the things that's really interesting is all this new technology and science has really changed our lives. And it's totally changed what we know and understand about trees. So mapping has been what's enabled everyone to realize, oh, trees are essentially markers of affluence. So there's a scientist I write about at some length in my book, Greg McPherson, and the city of LA wanted to plant 1 million trees, and they were wondering where could we put them. And so they had Greg, who's a U.S. Forest Service scientist at UC Davis, he'd done a lot of work with them, come down and map the city. And basically, and they said, and do it by councilmanic district, which we've also done here in Baltimore, thanks to Eric. And when you looked at it, I mean, Bel Air, the tree canopy was like 47%, and South Central was 6%. And so that really raised everyone's awareness. And that's been going on all over the country now, people looking at that. So someplace like Portland that you think of like, wow, they've got a great tree canopy. Well, they do, but on one side of the river. The other side of the river, which has always been sort of an industrial working class area, they realized, oh, actually, we don't have much of a tree canopy here. So the technology is incredibly helpful for thinking strategically.
And Eric, we have undertaken a tree census, as it were, here in Baltimore, so that we know where we have them, where we don't have them, where
right.
we need them.
We're in the process of that right now. The mayor's budget was kind enough to see to it that over primarily next year, we will have a complete comprehensive tree inventory of every single tree in Baltimore. And we'll use it as a management tool, but it'll also be where we can apply and see better economic benefits. We'll know exactly which tree. And Jill, for example, talks about iTree, and we'll be able to apply the iTree benefits to it.
I wanted to say, iTree is one of these programs, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm. It was developed by a number of folks that Jill mentions in her book and kind of hosted more or less, I'd say, by the U.S. Forest Service. I wanted to say real briefly, Tom, the flip side of where we have lower tree canopy cover and sometimes the more socioeconomically distressed neighborhoods. The upside of this is there are more studies coming on, and Jill talks about some of them in her book. So, for example, with lowering stress levels with school children and people having a feeling of peace. And there's some very recent studies, including folks, I believe, at Forest Service, probably Morgan Grove and some others. There's now some correlation. Is it causal? We're not sure, where there's even lower crime rates associated with a neighborhood that has a well-planted block of trees.
I had a guest on the program once. She's an ER doctor in Philadelphia, and mm-hmm. she did a study about vacant housing in Philadelphia. And she actually attached heart monitors to people for a week or so as they walked to and from school and from work. And she found that heart rates increased considerably when children in particular walked past vacant dilapidated houses, when they walked past parks, which her team purposely planted, you know, to have trees and shrubs and flowers and stuff, the heart rate lowered. And they were literally could measure the amount of stress and how it was being attenuated by their access to just being able to look at foliage and trees and stuff. Right. Lots to talk about. We will take a little break and come back and get through as much as we can. The author, Jill Jones, her new book is called Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. Eric Deal is the Baltimore Arborist and Chief of Urban Forestry here in town. You are welcome to join our conversation. Our telephone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday. Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Stick around. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. By the way, tomorrow on the program, Midday's resident foodies Sasha Wohlhandler and John Shields join me for our regular segment, What You Got Cookin'. They'll have last-minute Thanksgiving ideas, so if you're feeling behind in your Thanksgiving preparations, tune in, and John and Sasha will set your mind at ease. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us today, we're hoping to set your mind at ease about the tree canopy in Baltimore. It's getting better. My guests today are Jill Jones, the author of a new book, Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. She's the founder of the Baltimore Tree Trust as well, and she'll be speaking tonight at the Ivy Bookshop, and we'll have details about that event. Starts at 7 o'clock. You can come to our website, wipr.org/midday. Eric Deal joins us as well. He's the Baltimore Arborist and the Chief of Urban Forestry. So, Jill, in this election we just had, we found a deep divide between rural America and city America, urban America. You write that 4/5 of Americans live in or near cities. And in some states, like California, 95% of the people who live in California, and we think of California as a place with a lot of wide open space, but 95% of Californians live in cities. So this notion of urban forestry, of trees in urban environments, couldn't be more important in terms of numbers for people, right?
Yeah. Yes, which is why, as I've gone around talking about my book, I've been sort of taken aback at, one, just the term urban forest, which is something of an oxymoron, is not a familiar term, and just how little people know about the trees around them. So I wrote this book really as a labor of love and as part of my desire to educate people and generate the kind of enthusiasm for this prospect of living much more in nature and the fact that urban forests can do that for us. But in order to kind of move in that direction and live in much greener cities, you just need to know how this all works. And one of the most surprising things to people is the extent to which you can quantify all the wonderful things that trees do for us. So what happened historically in this country is when we urbanized in the progressive era, trees were really viewed as a form of public health because there was no air conditioning, so they brought the temperature down, and also they absorbed dust and stagnant water, and so trees were really planted in cities as a way to keep down especially child mortality. It was very explicit.
It was medicinal, essentially. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, interesting.
And most cities ended up with very beautiful, lush tree canopies that were largely American elms, which is, you know, the iconic, most architecturally beautiful of, I think, almost all trees. And very tragically, in the late 1920s, early 1930s, Dutch elm disease arrived on our shores. It had already wiped out most of the elms in Europe, and it actually is a fungus from Asia transported by bark beetles. So there was a heroic effort to try and contain this. It did not work. And so slowly but surely, over the next number of decades, because everything that happens with trees happens with tree time. Tree time is very slow. But cities lost their canopies. And there were cities where the street trees, I mean, 80% of them were elms, and they were magnificent. So that is a central theme through my book. But it does have a happy ending, because we once again have elms that can resist elm disease, and they are being planted, and they are as fabulous as ever. But that meant in the 70s, when 60s and 70s, when cities were really down on their luck, the tree people of the world realized that they were going to have to come up with some compelling reason that you should plant trees, because we now had air conditioning and we had modern medicine. And so a man named Rowan Rowntree, he was a scientist, and his two best-known graduate students, Greg McPherson and David Nowak, collectively began to lead this incredible research to establish what trees do in terms of ecosystem services, a terrible
phrase. Yeah, McPherson even came up with a number. He said, this tree is worth $2,775. I mean, he came up with some calculation, some metric to decide exactly what it was, quote unquote, worth.
Yes. Yeah. And there was, they did this science initially, the beginning of it in Chicago, and they were able to say things like, okay, so you have this street tree, and it is worth $47 in terms of what it saves in energy. And they built on this, and they...
So once people could make the economic argument for
right.
it, you know, it's not just an aesthetic argument, it's not just, someone in your book refers to it as the hedonic, meaning hedonism, hedonic value of trees. I'm interested, Erica, and the phones are ringing off the hook, so we're going to get to folks okay. who are calling in just a second. But Jill defines a tree in the very beginning of her book as saying, if you can walk under it, it's a tree, and if you can walk around it, it's a shrub.
Oh, I read that in her introduction. That was your last sentence in the intro. I loved it, Jill. We're slightly
would
different.
Would you buy that as an arborist? I just wonder.
85% of it, because we do have some trees that are what we would call multi-trunk trees, and they have naturally low branches. Dogwoods are
how
a great
many
example.
Of them do we have
and
involved?
We cannot quite walk under all the dogwoods involved.
Uh-huh. How many? I mean, I've heard the number 2.6 million trees in the city of Baltimore. Is that?
That's the best figure we have. It's 2.6 million. And like to capitalize on what Jill is saying, I consider the urban forest of Baltimore to be all the trees in Baltimore. The street trees, the woodland trees like in Gwynsalls Lincoln Park or Druid Hill Park, our parklands, and people's trees on private property, 2.6 million.
So Jill writes that some cities like New York plant as many as 100,000 trees a year. Other cities, the norm is often like 10,000 trees a year. How many are we planting here in Baltimore?
We're more at that norm at 10,000. Now, we want to ramp that up, and we're beginning to ramp it up more and more through our partnership and through a number of different funding sources, both federal and state and local. So we would like to get to more like 25,000. If we can reach that figure, don't hold me to it right now, but that will help us meet our goal of 40% tree canopy cover by the year 2037.
All right, so 2037. So we can get to 25,000 in 3 years, 5 years? Got a guess?
Well, we're going to do a lot bigger this year because we're having a number of different funding sources. If I take a guess, I would say we're at least 5 years away before we could start planting those numbers.
You're listening to Midday. That's Eric Deal. He's the arborist of Baltimore City and the chief of urban forestry. My other guest, Jill Jones, he's got a new book. It's really fascinating. It's called Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. The phones are blowing up, folks, so we got lots of folks very interested in trees. Tanya in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Thank you. I want to be sure you know about an exhibit called Baltimore Rising. Down on North Avenue at the Fred Lazarus Gallery. There are two quilts there by a local artist who teaches at MICA. Olivia Robinson has made two side-by-side quilts that show the relationship between redlining in Baltimore and the tree canopy that is planted in various neighborhoods where poor neighborhoods that were redlined, where mortgages were not available, insurance was not available. Those neighborhoods have much shorter, less valuable trees. She studied 150 neighborhoods and then reproduced the types of trees in those neighborhoods, and with little LED lights has highlighted the neighborhoods and where the trees are. And it's beautiful, but it's also really valuable information about redlining and its consequence on the tree.
Great. Thank you, Tanya, for that call. I appreciate you. I've not been able to go over and check it out myself, but I understand that that exhibition called Baltimore Rising at the Micah Lazarus Center on North Avenue is really terrific. So I appreciate your call. Elena in Windsor Mill, welcome to Midday with Jill Jones and Eric Deal.
Hi. Thank you for answering my call.
So what's on your mind? Glad you called.
So what's on my mind is I'm hearing from the author. I'm actually from Portland, Oregon, and I'm a transplant here in the Baltimore region. And I consider Portland to be a very forested area, both east and west of the river. The difference between the east and the west of the river is not industrialization. It happens to be that the majority of people that live in Portland live on the east side, and it's a flat topographical area. So there's denser housing, and it's harder to get as many trees as compared to the very hilly west side. And that, I think, goes for a lot here in Baltimore as well. You get the flatter area has higher density of people, and has less trees because there's just more buildings, more roads, more of everything. So yeah. What does she think about that, like when we're looking at just the density of the population and putting trees in?
All right, thanks for your call, Elena.
Well, the thing about Portland, I was told by someone from Portland, but I'm happy to hear your point of view. Yes, I think that's a big question. You know, how do you fit trees in? But we have an awful lot of asphalt. I mean, just look at parking lots and things like that. I mean, most people are not aware that the city of Baltimore is actually under an EPA mandate to lift up one quarter of its impervious surface downtown in order to diminish the amount of polluted stormwater that runs into the harbor and therefore into the bay. So, yeah, I think these are all challenges, and I think we are clearly in the process of rethinking our cities as we begin to have bike lanes, as we begin to try and have more green space. So, yes, in some places it's just going to be hard to fit in more trees because there are people and they're all living there.
And Eric, it's not just a matter of where you can put the trees, but also what kind of trees you put in there, right?
Absolutely. Like the previous caller mentioned, there seemed to be some kind of correlation between smaller, perhaps less beneficial trees, and we're certainly combating that. I want to see shade trees go in wherever possible. Easy on the cherries and the dogwoods and the cute small trees that have pretty flowerings. You know, we all love those trees, too. But given if we can have big enough tree pits, and that's one of our challenges, and all our partners in Baltimore City is working hard to create what we're calling additional tree wells or tree pits throughout the city, and we're planting trees in there, including these neighborhoods that have smaller tree, less tree canopy cover, with perhaps more economically challenged neighborhoods. So we are targeting those areas to make a difference.
Julia is on the line from Reservoir Hill. That's a neighborhood that I happen to know pretty well because I've lived there for 30 years, and we have a few tree pits, but not a whole lot of trees in general. Julia, welcome to the show. Thanks for your call.
Yes, an interesting subject, which is I've been trying to get involved in the tree thing here in Baltimore. My comment is that more attention needs to be paid to what kind of tree is planted along the sidewalks. There are five trees across the street from me who, by your definition, would be shrubs, although they're probably, I don't know, 10 to 15 feet tall by now. They're constantly vandalized because you can't park under them because the branches scrape the top of your car. You can't get in and out of the car without fighting the branches. You can't walk down the sidewalk without ducking or walking out in the street. And so people just break the branches off. And, I mean, they're beautiful trees. I don't know if someone would even want them in their lawn because you couldn't mow under them. And, you know, the branches are too low to the ground to be used along a street and a sidewalk.
Yeah, well, Julia, thanks for the call. So, Eric, what's the answer to that?
Those are perfect trees. We want to come along and raise the branches up so that people can walk underneath them and people can open their car doors and park underneath them. I'm not too far from Reservoir Hill myself, my office. I'm going to swing by there and find out exactly where we're talking about there. But this sounds like something that can be remedied. And I also agree with her comment that we need to have the right tree in the right place. It's an overused phrase, but it's absolutely true. We don't want to put big trees under power lines. We want to make sure they're tough urban trees, that their branches can be raised up enough so people can walk underneath them and park their cars.
It's the calorie pear tree, right? So, Jill, I mean, you're right about this as one that particularly here in Baltimore is somewhat ubiquitous, right?
Well, so the calorie pear. So one of the things that was really fun about doing this book is in a city, trees do not get in the ground unless people take action. And the world has been full of tree lovers for a long time. And my book starts in 1800 and comes up to this year. So cover a lot of territory and you meet a lot of really wonderful, eccentric tree lovers. And I was actually just telling Eric when we were waiting to come in here, that Frank Meyer, who was a plant explorer for the USDA in China, and is today mainly remembered for the Meyer lemon, is also responsible for the calorie pear. So he...
Now, can you actually get pears and take them off calorie pear trees? Do
no.
people eat them?
No.
Right, so that's a misnomer, because we have an email here from Lil, and she says, I've lived in Baltimore for over 40 years, and I remember eating fruits from the trees as a child. Why aren't fruit and nut trees planted more? Fruit trees in particular would help in providing food. So, why not?
That's a great question. Back on the calorie pears, they do have small little pears, but they're not edible. I noticed right in front of the WIPR building, you have a number of what we call Bradford pears. But they're really for ornamental purposes. I think more in the past, there were street tree plantings. One of our challenges is to make sure that we get community buy-in so they don't feel that if the fruit drops, it's a matter of rodents will be coming in and making an infestation. We're working closely with the Baltimore Orchard Project. Our Tree Baltimore program gives anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000 worth of fruit trees and fruit tree giveaways. We had one recently in Druid Hill Park. And we are pushing, one of the things I wanted to see done differently a little bit here when I came is let's embrace a more total community effort and interest, and including let's embrace fruit trees, even though they're not the biggest number of shade trees. I'm in favor of planting some fruit trees along the streets as long as we can be assured that we're going to make sure we harvest those fruit.
Here's an email from Brenda. She says, are you planning to replace the 100 trees that the mayor cut down a few years ago for the Baltimore Grand Prix?
I was asked that the first year I got here. I kind of inherited that. And the answer is yes, there was mitigation already taking place. A little bit to the north and to the west of where the trees were that were cut down for the Grand Prix project, they were planted. So we inch per caliper inch, the number of inches of trees lost were replanted with new trees. Again, up from Pratt Street, a little bit more to the north of the downtown area.
Yeah, I do remember that as a very controversial decision. Absolutely. Let's get one more phone call in before we take a break. Richard from Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Jill Jones and Eric Deal.
How you doing?
Good. How you doing? Thanks for your call.
I got two questions, and y'all can tell me the answer to this stuff. Y'all came to Drew Hill Park, and y'all put in all these trees that got pollen, and the asthma rate and the kids sick in our neighborhood and on... Any spring day, the whole neighborhood is yellow. Y'all cut down all the trees. Nobody asked y'all to do that. And it's just, and in the poor neighborhoods, all they are is weeds that y'all plant. And then I read that a lot of you all's funding comes from pharmaceutical companies that sell asthma products and stuff like that. And why are y'all planting so many pollen trees?
Okay.
In that area.
Well, Richard, thanks.
And calling them trees.
Thanks for your call. I don't think there's any evidence whatsoever that the pharmaceutical companies are funding pollen trees. In fact, Jill, you write in your book that trees and a rich tree canopy diminishes the effects of asthma. That's true, right?
Well, I think that.
But Richard's got a point. I mean, right. Certain times of year, folks are just sneezing their heads off.
Right. I mean, I have allergies to trees, and they really kick in the fall. I think that I sort of came to think about trees as not unlike cars in the sense that cars, we have all kinds of bad things associated with cars, accidents, pollutions, etc. But in the end, the good of cars outweighs the trouble they cause us. And I feel the same way about trees. I mean, yes, you have to deal with leaves. Yes, you have to deal with some, problems of response to the pollen and so forth. But the overall benefits of trees are just so fantastic that it's just a trade-off. And I don't know what Eric has to say about this, because Druid Hill Park is his bailiwick, and, so I think he might want to say something.
And we'll get back to Eric on that, because we got to take a little bit of break. But, of course, it's the old, the ever-popular cost-benefit analysis.
Exactly.
Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. That's the new book by Jill Jones, who joins me in the studio, along with Baltimore's arborist Eric Deal. You can join us as well when we come back from a break. 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around. Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about trees. Jill Jones has a new book, Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. She joins me here in Studio A along with Eric Deal, the Baltimore arborist and chief of urban forestry. Jill Jones will be talking about her new book tonight at 7 o'clock at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road in North Baltimore. You can join us as well. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. I want to go right back to the phones. John in Baltimore, thanks for joining Midday.
Hi there. I'm a landscape architect. I practice in Baltimore and Washington. And I have a question about the contrast between the tree canopy in Washington, where I was born and raised, and in certain urban areas like Canton and Fed Hill. I was born and raised 10 minutes north of Georgetown, and the tree canopy there is extraordinary. When I moved to Baltimore, I bought a property in Canton, and there's just nowhere near the amount of canopy in Canton that really should be. And I was frustrated by the bureaucracy of trying to plant a tree on my block in Canton, and, of course, the impediment of having to remove the concrete slab in order to create that tree well. Is there anything residents can do to actually expedite that process? I mean, I actually even fantasized about renting a jackhammer and taking it out myself and asking for forgiveness later. But I just feel the impediment of having so much concrete there could be alleviated if the city just went around and jackhammered out certain areas of the sidewalks so that residents can feel free to plant trees themselves.
So city arborist Eric Deal. Citizens with jackhammers.
Actually,
discuss.
I actually want to just butt in here and say this. So what we tell people is get a tree committee in your community. Join the forestry board, which is a volunteer organization, and work with...
Oh, Jill, though, a committee?
No.
Jackhammers are more fun than committees.
Well, your committee may be able then to go forth with multiple jackhammers. Actually, no, probably not. But if you get yourself organized, you can definitely get your neighborhood planted with trees. And Eric is very open to that.
So if you want a tree in front of your house, Eric, because sometimes the tree in front of your house dies or whatever. What's the process? What's the most expeditious way of getting that taken care of?
There's two ways to do it. One is to do it yourself, like the caller would like to do. And, hey, you sound great. You need to come to work with us here in forestry. We're all about jackhammering and opening up new tree pits and get community buy-in, of course, for folks to understand the benefits of having additional pits. And we will give you a tree from the Tree Baltimore program, a suitable-sized tree. The other way to do it is come on our website, our treebaltimore.org website. Again, it's part of Recreation and Parks Department. And we will have a tree, large, big, 400 or 500 pound, big old massive tree planted for you within a year or less, either spring 2017 or 2018. We do request 700-800 trees a year, but we also give away thousands and thousands of trees every year for people to plant either on their property or we can work, as Jill says, with a community group, or we can set you up and plant your own tree right in front of your house. There is a little bit of process of breaking up your own concrete. There's some guerrilla gardeners out there that may do it on occasion. I can't condone that. We can help you expedite through the process of getting a tree pit if you really want to jackhammer and do that yourself.
So Jill, the caller mentioned Washington and the tree canopy there. And before we go, we do have a bunch more calls, and I will try to get to them. But I do want you to tell us about Eliza Skidmore. There are a bunch of really fascinating characters in your book. She's the one that led the effort to get the cherry trees planted in Washington. It took her 27 years yes. to finally get this. And they tried it once, and then they all died, and then they had to get a new shipment.
So Washington, as the caller would know, is known as the City of Trees, and it has a long, illustrious history of trees. And we, of course, it's now famous for the cherry trees, and Eliza Skidmore, and I'm actually planning to talk about this tonight at the Ivy because I just think it's such a great story. But extremely briefly, Eliza Skidmore was one of those formidable Victorian women who was a journalist and a war correspondent. And in 1885, she went to Japan where her brother was the U.S. consul in Yokohama. And she arrived in time to attend the cherry blossom festivals. And she was utterly smitten. And there were a few Japanese ornamental cherry trees already in the United States, but very few. This was a very rare thing to see. And she just felt that this would be wonderful for Washington. And she came back, and as you've already pointed out, it took her a very long time to finally make this happen. But I think of the Washington Cherry Blossom Festival as the largest instance of tree worship, intense tree worship that goes on here in the United States. What I gather is about a million people descend on those trees. And I actually have tried numerous times before I finally made it myself. It's not easy to reach those trees. And actually, Eric and I, who are both on the Forestry Board, again, an organization I urge people to become a member of, and I should also mention that we have in this city a tree keeper's classes so people can become expert on all things to do with trees.
It's our tree stewardship program.
Yes.
You can get engaged with your community, and I will sign a certificate that allows you to prune trees from the ground in your own neighborhood.
And also to plant trees.
And for planting trees.
Yeah. But anyway, so one of the things we've been talking about at the Forestry Board is trying to figure out how to have what we call a flowery path that would wend its way through Baltimore, because actually I went to Japan for the Cherry Blossom Festival a couple of years ago, and it was just truly such a joyous, wonderful
thing. Do we have a place
thing.
Like the banks of the Potomac River, which is where they're planted in D.C.? I mean, Eric, if we were going to have a beautiful, windy path of flowering trees like dogwoods or cherry blossoms, where would we put it, do you think?
I can see groves of them. I got mixed feelings that we're going to make boulevards lined with cherry trees. We're not maximizing our shade tree benefit that way, but Jill and I have had this conversation before, but there are groves or groups. For example, Druid Hill Lake. Come to Druid Hill Park and look mm-hmm. at the wonderful cherry groves. We can add to that. And I think there's other places throughout the city we could make these groves.
We have a caller who wants to talk about the parks. Monroe from O'Donnell Heights. Welcome to Midday. What's your question?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm just wondering, why hasn't Baltimore City tried doing something with Druid Hill Park or Patterson Park like New York City did with when they created Central Park? And I'll listen on the air.
So Monroe's contention is that we have fewer trees than we could have in Druid Hill Park or Patterson Park. Certainly, Patterson Park and Druid Hill Park have open areas where you could plant more trees, and you don't have to jackhammer any sidewalks in those places.
That's true. I must say we have master plans. The city has a master plan for both Patterson Park and Druid Hill Park. And just like Central Park, we have open areas where folks can do things and enjoy the trees in the distance. They're kind of clustered and grouped. We got to make sure we have room for the ball field still and people playing frisbee. And having their kids out tumble on the lawn. So I believe we are filling our master plan with the max amount of trees that will also allow the best community engagement to use these parks.
It's always a trade-off, isn't it?
It
is. We have an email from Ron, and Jill, you write about this in your book a lot. He says, planting trees is great, but taking care of them is equally important. Is the budget for maintenance here in Baltimore and cities across the country improving? And you have folks in the book quoted as saying, people throw it in a hole that's not big enough, and they put all this junk around it, and then they starve it to death with no water, and the thing dies.
Yeah, well, that was actually one of the things about writing this book is that I would read what people were writing or saying, back in the 19th century, and I would think, You know, that is the thing about trees. Trees have not changed. And the problems of, everyone loves to plant trees. And then the question becomes, well, what happens after that? And the city of Sacramento, their tree group says it takes 5 years to plant a tree, by which they mean, you know, just putting the tree in the ground is just the beginning after that. And we at the Tree Trust, one of the things we're very proud of is that we water our trees for the 2 years after they're planted. And actually, if the weather is really dry, we will, you know, go into another year, because it's such an investment. And, you know, by the time you get a tree into the ground, Eric, what is it costing for a street tree?
Well, if they're the big ones, they can cost up to $400, but that doesn't per tree, but that includes the 2 years establishment period you're talking about. And then the city is putting in place other programs to ensure that that establishment continues longer. I wanted to say real briefly, Tom, the good news for your listeners, I think forestry and rec and parks has gone through some tough times, but we're on the upswing. We are have the Baltimore Energy Initiative, which allows us to plant $1.4 million worth of trees. We have a lot of tree planting money coming in, but what we're talking about here is the aftercare, and you're not going to get a good tree canopy cover unless you take care of the teenagers and adults. So the city has initiated a Proact the Tree Pruning neighborhood. Our goal is to go through every neighborhood in Baltimore and prune every single tree that is 5 inches or greater in diameter. The tree keepers can help take care of the smaller ones. And that's going to ensure that if we take care of that oak tree now, that may be a bit of a mess, whatever, we're going to have less damage in the future. We're going to have a better tree canopy, and we're going to reap the benefits.
And those plastic bags that are put around the young trees that are planted, I understand that those exist so that they capture the water. And the young trees then get water, have a source for water even when it's not raining.
I don't think they really capture the water.
So what are they for?
You have to come along, you have to pour the water into the bag, and then it slowly dissipates throughout the
system. So why are the bags there then? What's the deal?
So what you do is, they're called gator bags. They have a little opening, and you put your hose in it, and it fills up with 20 gallons. And for a very long time, I used to look at them, and they were always empty. And I thought, well, so this is kind of pointless, until I actually read the instructions, which is, so the 20 gallons is, you know, what is good for a week. And it only takes, you know, 5 to 24 hours for that water to go through. I mean, I actually have a very vivid memory of going down to McElderry Park in the very early days. And Amanda Cunningham, who has been at this with me all these years, and she's a certified arborist, and we personally, using neighborhood hoses, filled all of the gator bags for these trees that we'd planted with the neighbors. And the next day we were down there again, and the bags were just utterly empty because the water had gone into, so for the, you know, next week, it would look like nothing was happening. Like, what's going on with these?
Yeah. Well, we're not going to be able, unfortunately, to get to a bunch of calls that we have here. Rod from Baltimore has a comment that said, talking about the caller that said she used to eat fruit from city fruit trees. He says, I grow fruit trees, and they require a lot of work. I mean, that's the thing. If we're going to plant these things, we got to get it right.
They do. They do require a good amount of work.
Well, thanks to both of you for coming by. Jill Jones is the author of the new book, Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. She'll be reading from her book tonight at 7 o'clock at the Ivy Bookshop in North Baltimore. We've got more information and a link to the Ivy on our website, wipr.org/midday. Eric Deal is Baltimore's city arborist and chief of urban forestry. He heads up Tree Baltimore and the city's public-private initiative to increase the tree canopy. Thanks to Joe Squared as well for providing lunch for our guests today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours are at joesquared.com. That'll do it for us today on Midday. Coming up tomorrow on the program, our super foodies Sasha Wohlhandler and John Shields return for What You Got Cooking. And you guessed it, we'll talk turkeys and all the fixins. That's coming up tomorrow. We'll see you then. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Go plant a tree and have a great day.